Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editors of the magazine that really, really should relocate to Florida gather each week to shout about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hola, amigos.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Two of the four of us spent part of last week in an actually free part of America, the Independent Republic of Miami Stan, where coverings of certain parts of your body are super optional. I got to talk about it just a little bit because I see the world a little bit differently, beginning to understand how my neighbor-ish person, New York Post columnist Carol Markowitz, who spent 4 months during the pandemic down in Florida with her kids, why she won't shut her trap about all the ridiculous restrictions that still exist in New York after having lived in a free place. Nick, do you want to explain to our Stockholm Syndrome colleagues what it's like to be in a place where the only even reminders that there might have been a virus is like at the airport?
It feels good. You know, at least for the 3 or 4 days I was down there, it made me actually think about moving to Florida, which is a terrible climate. Otherwise, it's just hot and muggy and awful in so many ways, as I'm sure Peter can attest to actually living there for a good chunk of his life. But it's the sign of things to come for sure.
It's crazy the sense of vitality there. I came back last night and it was like I can't imagine wearing a mask in a subway again. It was so infuriating.
You know, to be fair, Matt, you were also drinking. From what I understand, I mean, we only saw each other for a few hours, but from what I understand, you were drinking like full time, so you know your need not to be masked is perhaps stronger than the normal American.
If you're mid sip, you don't have to wear a mask, and if you're always mid sip, you never have to.
He
wear
had
a mask.
Phone dome on with like you know a 20 a whole case of beer.
Nick, if you remember the way to
White
do this,
claw up there
from back in your salad days of drinking, the way that you handle event-based drink management is to get it out of your system the first night and then sip the rest of the time. I want to...
You know, I wish you had told me that. I don't know. But when did we first meet? Like 2003, Matt?
Really?
Like, I'm already... Now I'm going through an alternate timeline.
Matt Welch.
Who's someone who does the pour apple juice to make it look like bourbon trick, because there's just no way that you can keep up.
I think Dino used to do that.
I'm curious now, even as the weather gets unbearable into summer and you look around and you notice things, Catherine, like, oh, you know, nobody between the ages of 12 and 17 apparently died of COVID in the first quarter of this year. Right now in your life around you, which lingering anachronistic restriction gives you the most fury, either personally or just gazing upon it in the direction of California from afar?
I am so happy at how much progress we've made that I actually have low fury at the moment.
That's great.
I'm reporting low fury levels. I went to a schmancy dinner for my husband's birthday on Saturday, and
happy birthday.
Schmancy better than fancy?
Yes,
schmancy?
It is. It's self-consciously fancy.
I see.
It was like this place was like, why? Yes, we are going to tell you about the person who picked each individual grape in this wine. It was schmancy. That's the technical term. And we walked in with the mask on, immediately removed it. Did not put it back on for the rest of the dinner. And the wait staff, as the volume grew in the restaurant, abandoned their masks according to their preferences. So by the time we were at like the second course, everyone was unmasked. Everyone was happy. It was delightful. And then I went to the pool and...
not immediately afterwards. Right?
Not immediately afterwards. The following day...
You
gotta
wait 30 minutes,
like
right? You gotta wait 30 minutes.
The following day, I went to the pool because you don't want to get a cramp. And... technically, again, masks were required. We put on the mask to sign in at the front desk of the public pool, and then no one had a mask on for any minute after that. So, like, people are behaving in a way that appropriately reflects the risk in Washington, D.C., which is right now very, very low.
I kind of like food servers, maybe not waiters, but food preparers wearing masks.
You just feel like it's like a sanitary kind of
It's kind of
vibe.
Like a pooper scooper law, like what took so long?
Right.
You know?
But it
because
also has
it
a cool
is...
post-apocalyptic kind of vibe. Like
yeah.
when they're replaced with robots, we won't even notice because we haven't
true,
seen
yeah.
their faces for years.
Yeah. No, but my younger son who works in food preparation said that while he finds it, I won't name his national chain that he works
it
at.
Rhymes with Schmapple-bees.
But he was like, you know, there's so much grossness that comes out of people preparing food because they're working hard, and why not wear a mask?
Peter, I feel like you're Florida, man. You should tell me and Nick why we shouldn't relocate our lives to Florida in the context of COVID restrictions. Go.
I mean, maybe you should.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I'm from Florida, and I don't want to move back there.
Yeah.
It's too hot, and it's fun when you don't live there. When you live there, eventually the crazy gets to you. Now, some people enjoy that, but there's the Florida man thing is at least a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's not entirely an exaggeration because people just go batshit crazy in Florida all the time, and really nutty stuff happens. So I grew up in the panhandle of Florida, which is very different than Miami, but they both have sort of signature kind of local craziness. And, you know, some people thrive on that. Some people love it. And in a pandemic where the rest of the world goes crazy in a completely different way, yeah, maybe you should move to Florida. Maybe that's the place to be. I'll be honest. I'm definitely jealous of my Florida friends when they're like, "What pandemic, man?" And I'm like, "No, it happened. I was there." And they're literally just like, "I've been fishing." And I'm like, because I'm from the Alabama part of Florida, since Florida is really three states. It's Southern Alabama, Southern Ohio, that's Central Florida, which is actually demographically like almost exactly like Ohio. And then basically there's Miami, which you might, if you call Northern Cuba, right? And they're three totally different states that somehow or another ended up politically the same. No, it's a weird place.
And running the whole country.
Yes, and now also running the whole country. It's a weird place. I don't wish to move back there. But if I have ever wished to move back there, if I have ever had that feeling in my heart, it has been over the last couple of months, weeks, year, etc. Because it just seems like a place where their craziness was actually, like, the state's inherent batshit nuttiness was actually a pretty good response, or at least I don't know, good response. It wasn't as bad as people were saying, and it sort of worked out, and some people had fun, and I don't know, am I gonna say that's bad?
Speaking of the Star Wars cantina scene, Nick, you were in Miami specifically for a ginormous first ever, or whatever you can characterize it as you would like, Bitcoin conference. You're down there with your Reason TV colleagues interviewing people. I guess Floyd Mayweather made a speech. Paris Hilton did something.
Talk
or
about
other.
A triumph of the human spirit. Floyd Mayweather speaking in public.
he was
especially when he's reading from a script.
I was going to say he wasn't reading a teleprompter, probably, but like the floating apparition of Ron Paul was teleported in there. Tell us,
Ron Paul was there in the flesh.
Oh, okay.
I went to the Bitcoin 2021 Miami conference. It was not clear at all that it actually had a title. As you would expect for something celebrating a decentralized, dispersed kind of experimental.
I mean, was there a title that maybe you had to like decode through cryptography?
Yeah, no, I was going to say it was.
You never figured out the cipher.
Nick didn't get the key.
I didn't stick around. I didn't have enough in my blockchain to understand that. It was also in a way it was very hard to figure out what was going on where, et cetera, but it was spectacular. The organizer said there were about 12,000 registered people there. The speakers included Jack Dorsey, Ross Ulbricht made a guest. He beamed in from prison.
That's amazing.
Tony Hawk, Ron Paul, Eric Voorhees.
Was he on the blockchain?
You know, are you gonna work with that, Peter? I think you might want to workshop that a little bit.
I just assumed that person who was not there in the flesh somehow or another was communicating via the blockchain. Because I feel like that's the whole thing here now, is that all digital things should just be on the blockchain.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, nobody said that. I expected everybody to end every conversation with, like, and I'm going to put X on the blockchain. Never came up. The other thing that is most kind of characteristic of Bitcoin people is an absolute lack of humor, pretty much in general, but especially about Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency in general. Because these guys, you know, I would say like about 25% to 30% of the attendees and the speakers were women. So it was, you know, somewhat in the ballpark of a libertarian event, but, you know, probably more ambisexual. But these people are in a fight against fiat currency, which was often likened to slavery.
Only difference Holocaust comparisons too, or
that gets rolled into the fiat slavery, currency, yeah. You know, bankrolled all of the great murders of the 20th century.
They're not wrong.
So, you know, pretty much all of us who are still using ATM cards, like every time you put that in to a slot at an ATM, you are paying the bill for, you know, the concentration camps, the gulag, you name it. But it was a spectacular event. And I think the level of energy, or if I may also, the real breakout star there was a senator from Wyoming, former congresswoman from Wyoming, Cynthia Lummis, who a kind of like Barry Goldwater style Republican, you know, limited government, you know, blah, blah, blah. We talked to her and Reason will be rolling out interviews for the next 1,000 years, you know, from this conference, all of them great. But we talked to her and she also gave an incredible set of remarks to the assembled throng. You know, she sees Bitcoin as a way of simultaneously as a way of disciplining the U.S. Treasury. Because it is a non-inflationary currency, but also an escape hatch in a way. And I mean, she's not in any way, shape or form, you know, a kind of crazy black helicopter type person. What she's saying is like, this is a parallel monetary system which should be celebrated and should be built out. And one of its best effects in this world is that it will force the U.S. government and everybody else to kind of get in line. Towards the end of the conference, there was also a big announcement that the government of El Salvador, the president, Bukele, who is an awful authoritarian tyrant, he said he's passing legislation or pushing legislation that will allow El Salvador to use people in El Salvador to use Bitcoin as legal tender. It's not exactly clear what that means, but it is a major step in the kind of legitimization and authorization of Bitcoin, you know, from the existing world. And what I was going to say, and I'll shut up in a sec here, is that it is, you know, this, I think when we look back in 5 years or 10 years or 50 years, you know, or our heads in a jar look back in 1,000 years, this had the sensibility of a watershed moment, because it was bringing in, you know, people from the real world like Tony Hawk, people from the past like Ron Paul, people from, you know, meaningful cultural figures like Ross Ulbricht, and talking about Bitcoin, normalizing it. And it was almost all the discussion. It's not about speculation. It's not about getting rich. It's not about any of that kind of stuff. It's actually building out an alternative parallel banking system and financial system that ultimately is deeply entwined with human rights and the ability to maintain privacy, as well as to avoid inflation and other kind of weird shit coming out of conventional government. So it was a wonderful event, very inspiring.
Suderman, let's pick up on that kind of escape hatch competition against national governments, and also, you know, not speculation. I recall a conversation I was having with a couple of friends who take their crypto investing kind of seriously, and who also have libertarian sympathies, and like, okay, how much of the action that you are tracking out there is people saying to themselves, hey, you know what, we need to have an investment alternative to national governments who are all inflating their currencies and debasing their currencies? And how much of it is like gambling? They just want to triple their money in 2 months. And they're like 99% gambling. My question to you, Peter, is that there's a backdrop to this, perhaps available, which is, I think it was last week's agreement or semi-agreement among the G7 to have a floor on international corporate tax rates at 15% or higher. How much do you think that there is like a legitimate kind of need and increasing opportunity for this separate thing, this non-nation state pegged thing? Just kind of what is your overall take about that G7 agreement and international tax coordination?
So the G7 agreement comes out of the belief amongst a bunch of kind of center and left policymakers right now that there's just a ton of money that should be paid in taxes according to the law, basically as it exists, and that we are not collecting enough of it somehow or another. And this is a kind of, there are some specifics that are attached to this belief, but this is also just a sort of like very big picture, vague belief that is not entirely attached to specifics. And so Biden's budget plan, for example, thinks that we're going to get somewhere between like $700 billion and $1 trillion in additional tax revenue based on, not on actually increasing taxes anywhere, but just based on giving the IRS more resources. And so we will do more tax enforcement and we will get more revenue based on the law that already exists. And there's a bunch of good reasons to be skeptical of that. Congressional Budget Office says, wait, that's way too high. You're not going to get nearly that amount of money. A bunch of the more sort of sober and responsible analysts have just said, there's no way you're actually going to get that amount of money, because even if you really step up enforcement and harass people, which is what a stepped up enforcement amounts to, is just a lot of IRS harassment, what you're going to end up doing is that organizations and individuals with resources will find ways, in most cases, basically legal ways. The IRS might argue against that, so that's why I say basically legal, but essentially legal ways to shield their money, because people with resources end up finding ways to do this. And so what the G7 agreement about is, well, one way that they do that is by taking their money overseas. But the G7 agreement, again, is very vague. It's not really clear what 15% of what. Right. Like 15% of profits, of net operating, like, and then, OK, so if you're going to say that's a floor, then you're going to say that all of these totally legitimate, quite useful tax carve outs, ways, things that you that like, so businesses can, for example, buy stuff and sort of invest in things and do R&D, and that they're not making profit off of that directly. And so, as a result, they don't get taxed on it. And that's one of the reasons why companies like Amazon sometimes end up, you know, you hear politically, oh, they didn't pay any tax. Well, they reinvested that money into stuff that wasn't directly taxable because it is it's doing something useful. And so it's not clear that all those companies would actually give up those, excuse me, that all those countries would actually give up those breaks. And so this the agreement there is really just it's a way of all those of those countries coming together to affirm that they agree with Joe Biden and Janet Yellen that there's a bunch of uncollected tax money just sort of sitting out there waiting for governments to pick it up if they step up enforcement. And I think it is certainly possible to step up enforcement and to harass a bunch of people. The IRS could definitely be doing a lot more of that. I don't think that it would result in a whole lot more money going into national government coffers. I think it would just result in a lot of harassment and in organizations and individuals, like I said, who have resources, finding ways out, which may or may not include Bitcoin. Now, I think Bitcoin has some political risk attached to it, because as long as human beings ultimately need to interact with economies that are based on government-backed fiat currency, then at some point there's got to be a transfer between Bitcoin and, say, the US dollar. And if the US dollar continues to be controlled by the US government, then the US government...
If.
Yes, right?
I like your
yes. Well,
I like it.
Presuming that that's the case, then the U.S. government can regulate and restrict that sort of thing. And so that's, I don't think that's necessarily a deal breaker for Bitcoin or for cryptocurrency at all, but it is, there is real political risk to the extent that legislators start to feel like, oh, wait, this is a threat to us. In the same way that legislators have started to feel like other aspects of big tech are threats to sort of a centralized government power, they might end up coming in and trying to regulate transfers back and forth, and that could at least complicate things. But I think that, you know, in some ways, people get too hung up on this technology simply as a currency, as an alternative to fiat currency and to fiat money. It may or may not end up working out great. Like, I don't know about the currency aspect. But the underlying technology is just obviously incredibly useful, because what the underlying technology does is it establishes a system of trust that does not require a human or institutional intermediary. Right. That's like, so when you go pay for something at a restaurant, when you walk into a bar in Miami without a mask on and order a drink and eventually give the bartender your credit card, there's Visa or MasterCard or whoever is in between you and the bar. There is an intermediary that is run by human beings and that takes a cut. And there is no intermediary run by a centralized organization with Bitcoin. And yet you can trust it. Right. Both sides know that this is a trustworthy transaction. And that is the real value of Bitcoin and the blockchain and all this other stuff, is that it creates a system of trust between two people without a human centralized institutional intermediary, which means you don't need a government. You don't need Visa. You don't need your big corporation, whatever it is. You just have a system that's out there and that works. And every time you use it, every time you make Bitcoin, every time you sort of contribute to this, right, you are strengthening that network. And so I am extremely bullish on the underlying technology, even if I think that there are some outstanding questions about whether or not it's going to function really, really well as a currency alternative.
Catherine,
if I may just say, Matt, to go back to this question of a global base, you know, tax rate. Tax competition is something that was ballyhooed in, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it's been pretty much strangled to death. But tax competition among OECD countries, developed countries, as well as so-called tax havens, et cetera, there is no way to stop that ultimately, because this is, Matt, it's like the baseball team owners, you know, deciding, okay, we're not going to pay a lot for any players. And, you know, at the famous meeting in the 80s where they were deciding that different owners would be like, I got to go out and take a leak, and then immediately try and sign somebody to a massive contract in total, you know, abeyance of what they were discussing at the table. That's going to happen. But more to the point, this is also, and I'm, you know, I'm sitting in the Reason HQ booth with Catherine, and it makes me think of her continuing refrain of, like, when Joe Biden says, I'm going to cut child poverty in half, and the fucking press says, like, Joe Biden has cut child poverty in half. It's the same thing with raising tax revenue. I mean, are reporters this lazy that they think that by saying, okay, we're going to beef up the IRS, we're going to get more money out of the economy? The fact of the matter is they'll harass people. But, you know, the U.S. amount of revenue relative to GDP in the post-war era has averaged about 17.5% of GDP. We have never been able to get it higher than that for more than a couple of years, usually in a spike year because of some kind of change. So people realize a lot of tax revenue, like a capital gains tax at the end of the 90s. It's just not going to happen. And this is just one more way where both Biden and, you know, people in Washington are defying reality, thinking that they're going to jack up the actual amount of revenue that they're bringing in. But it's most, you know, let's focus on the press and them just falling asleep at the switch of the, you know, they should be incredulous towards claims that the government is going through merely enforcing the tax laws better is going to bring in like a whole new set of, you know, a new set of play money to spend on shit they want.
Whenever we talk about international tax competition, I always think of Tana French novels. So she is an Irish mystery novelist who has been writing since the late aughts. And in the background of all of her novels is the fact that all of her novels are set in Ireland, which famously has a like quite low corporate tax rate that was designed to lure in international investment money and corporations. And so in the background of all her novels is this sort of this boom that was in particular in real estate and sort of corporations moving money into Ireland. And there is a like it's these her novels are kind of fascinating economic studies, even though they are basically just like interesting psychological mysteries. They're fascinating economic studies of a country for a time at least, was really bringing in a lot of business and a lot of international capital by dramatically lowering their corporate tax rate.
One way to check on the bad journalism about this stuff, and I'm giving myself a Reason.com assignment out loud here, is to let's mark the 10-year anniversary, which should be coming up soon, of the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, otherwise known as FATCA, which was supposed to, you know, make Mitt Romney pay real taxes instead of hiding it all in Switzerland. And the projections of how much money was going to be raised by the IRS with that were so astronomical and laughable. Didn't happen at all. They got pennies on the dollar of what was promised. And meanwhile, the compliance was such that there are record numbers of middle class Americans who have dual citizenship who renounced their U.S. citizenship because of super onerous tax reporting requirements. Catherine Mangu Ward, your second husband, Elon Musk, has been having a weird relationship with cryptocurrency. I've lost the plot of where he was going. I don't know if you watched the Saturday Night Live he was on 2-3 weeks ago, but like on the Weekend Update thing, he was asked to define what Dogecoin was. And that was the joke. Like he just kept saying things and none of it actually made sense. And like, why was he goofing on it? But the headlines that he made during, or he didn't make, but during the Bitcoin conference was Anonymous came out and did a Elon Musk, we are coming for you video. So I guess my question is basically, is this the future that libertarians want?
Yeah. So I watched the Anonymous video. And one thing that was really striking to me is that if you took away the like Matrix green special effects and the voice box and the movie score behind it, that it was just like a blog post we could have published at Reason.com that would have been like a fairly reasonable narrative. Like it was all very like, as you say, but like, in fact, what they
what
were
was it like,
it was a David Root record from the 90s. Yeah,
it was a David Root record from the 90s, not a Meredith Bragg record from the 90s. They're different. And what they were actually saying was a sort of reasonable thing, which was like, hey, a lot of y'all out there like Elon Musk. He's done some legit stuff, and that legit stuff might have distracted you from the fact that he's kind of a narcissist and a dick. And also, by the way, that he's gotten a lot of government money, some of which he's legitimately used to do legit stuff, and some of which he's used to, like, subsidize some wacky narcissistic stuff. And that's it. That's what the video said. And that's true, right? Like, that's uncontroversially true. And the idea that, like, because of that thing, which has been manifestly, obviously true for a very long time, that Anonymous is coming after him with the overlay of, hey, a lot of ordinary people were hoping to make money on crypto. And for Elon, it's a game. And so that sucks. Like, ordinary people are not entitled to make money speculatively on crypto any more than Elon Musk is.
Wait, so you're siding with Elon?
I'm pro Elon, as always. Yes, he has consumed just a ton of government money in a super wasteful way. Like, I'm not denying that.
On the other hand, rockets, right?
On the other hand, rocket. Like, I mean, I know we're joking.
But he's just
totally
bringing
stuff.
He's like bringing up new Pampers to the International Space Station. He's not really, or he's putting Bitcoin on the moon. He's like
give him a minute. Okay. But like he's done a lot more, both in the realm of building and selling electric cars,
rockets,
and also building and selling rockets, than a lot of people who have talked really big and been equally narcissistic douchebags who have consumed a ton of government money but not delivered the product. And you got to give the guy credit that he's actually delivered. Anyway, I thought that the Anonymous video was both completely correct, and when you strip it of its theatrics, was like, yeah, like I think I've written that Like, it's fine?
I will point to a Reason video that can't be more than 2 months old, I think, that is 5 ways Elon Musk and other billionaires rip off corporate welfare. Yeah.
And, you know, it's true. In the video, they also say, hey, Elon, like, I hope you're enjoying your kind of moment at the top of the heap here. But there is a lot of competition in all these spaces that you are currently excelling in. And I just saw a headline that says Jeff Bezos and his brother are going to space together on a Bezos rocket, like, in July. Like, it's true. There is a lot of competition.
Wait, they're actually going into space. They're going into, like, suborbital
they're gonna
orbit
ride
or something?
A,
or,
one of the,
so
the
it's not
new
that
Shepherd.
They're putting a new... rocket up.
We're going to fire Jeff Bezos into the sun.
Just with a catapult, actually. Okay.
Is he going to fire himself into the sun on purpose because he's like, that would be awesome?
But I do think it makes sense to me. Yeah, maybe. But I do. He's had a year also. Like, who knows where he's at mentally and emotionally. But
he may never come back.
I think, you know, this idea that we were talking about earlier of like, nation states have sort of collectively decided to abdicate the tax competition thing. Like, they're like, okay, we're going to make this deal and not do tax competition. A, they're lying. But B, it doesn't matter if they're lying, because as always, a useful thing that's being proposed, governments aren't going to do it. It's going to be through crypto or some other extra governmental third party.
You know, interestingly, because Jack Dorsey was speaking at the Bitcoin conference, and Dorsey is, you know, highly controversial because of the way he's run Twitter. That is, I think that got almost 110% approval rating at the conference, but and the fact that he's keeping it tight. You know, I mean, he is also, like, more than any male or female tech CEO, the guy obviously has an eating disorder that he's masking as,
oh,
you know,
you
some
meant
kind
physically,
of
physically, like, his bod is keeping it. I assumed that you meant, like, he was running a type shit.
So
Nick,
at Twitter, and I was like, that's not
but
true.
If I
Nick.
May,
Nick
if
Dorsey has actually talked about his diet, and he walks like a zillion miles a day and only eats one meal.
Yes, he, like I said, he has an eating disorder. If he was running Spanx, people would be like, what the hell's going on? You know, we can't get them tight enough on him anymore. In any case, what was curious to me is that Dorsey is spending money building out crypto networks as well as peer-to-peer communications and payment networks that are building off of a social messaging service that will be like Twitter without a central server or database, and something similar with Square Payments, which he's also in charge of. These are radical things, and the people there were, you know, they may or may not like, you know, the way he runs Twitter, a lot of people there worry about social media being too powerful and controlling discourse, including Twitter. But Dorsey was the man of the moment there, the billionaire of the moment. The other thing that was interesting is a number of people pointed out that, like, Elon Musk, you know, is pumping up, you know, pumping and dumping Dogecoin. He, you know, is saying odd things about Bitcoin. Tesla did not sell its holdings, even after he said they were not going to accept it as payment for cars anymore. But the most important thing is a number of people noted, and this is true, like, you know, Bitcoin and other cryptos took a dive when Elon Musk started kind of shitting on it, but it didn't actually scare people out of the market. He does not matter. Like, Bitcoin, which, you know, in the past year has gone from having a $1 trillion valuation to $700 billion. It's bigger than many countries. It's one of the biggest currencies on the planet by volume. Like, it's not going away. And that was kind of one more indicator that Bitcoin and crypto is here to stay, that it's not going to be flushed away by the errant comments of a narcissistic billionaire.
This just in, our 44th and 46th president, Donald J. Trump, this morning on Fox Business said Bitcoin is a scam competing against the dollar. So Trump is not having your happy talk, Nick, and not for the first time. We're going to go to more darker applications here in a moment. But first, is online privacy even possible? Yes, it is. There's a surefire way to protect your personal information and online habits, Peter, without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your bits. Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are in effect. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other intrusive laws. Secure email and instant messaging services are safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google, other ones. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. You'll be glad you did. All right. There was a headline last week, Wall Street Journal, news exclusive. FBI director compares ransomware challenge to 9/11. Communism. That too. Christopher Wray, who's somehow still the FBI director, it seemed like a character from a show that we'd canceled, called the disruption and prevention of cyber attacks a shared responsibility, not just across government agencies, but across the private sector and even the average American, unquote. This is it against the backdrop of ransomware attacks on pipelines, on like ferries. It was on a Martha's Vineyard ferry. They've been doing it.
My God.
If we can't keep, you know,
Dershowitz, if we can't keep Dershowitz on the vineyard, we're just screwed as a society.
You're going to make Dershowitz put his pants on at this rate. Suderman, you are a hospital director. Ransomware has been like hitting hospitals forever, right? Can you talk a little bit about the kind of resurgence of ransomware as a hot topic?
Existential threat.
What do we get? Like, you guys live in DC. Like, every advertisement is like for cybersecurity, right? Like,
The whole metro, like every single ad on the metro is somehow either for like getting your systems to talk to each other or protecting your systems from talking to other people's systems.
The two polar opposite things, right? Either this system is fully like walled off from the world, or the system talks to all the other systems, and what they want or systems people want are systems that do both, and it's kind of a problem.
It's going to work out fine.
Last advertisement, if we come to think of it, go on.
A little. I can't believe that it still works to compare stuff to 9/11, and that gets you a headline. Like, how is that still working? How is this?
What you are at
7/11.
How is Ray out here just being like, oh, this is important. Think of it as another 9/11. And people are like, ooh, interesting. Okay, now I will pay attention. No, everything's been another 9/11.
Yeah, I don't think it's another 9/11. It seems different.
Has an Islamo-fascist group done a ransomware yet? Al-Qaeda? I mean, if Anonymous is getting back online... Ransomware. You know, where's Al-Qaeda?
Don't like conjure that into being. Like, don't like summon that into the.
It's Al-Nusra,
universe.
Nick.
Like they're, a white lady on Instagram.
More tech skill. But seriously, Suderman, have you followed over the years the centrality of hospitals? Like, they've been getting ransomwared for nigh on a decade here.
Accident that has happened as. Hospitals have increasingly gone digital and had huge problems in the post-stimulus era. And I mean the post-2009 stimulus era, which funded a whole bunch of hospital. Maybe it was Obamacare. One of the two big spending things President Obama did. In any case,
we're going to go paperless records.
I think it was actually in the stimulus. But there was a bunch of billions in there for creating medical records that could interoperate between systems, and it just didn't work at all. I mean, they spent a bunch of money, they digitized a bunch of things, but the interoperability just really did not work at that point. Look, ransomware is a problem. I don't think it's another 9/11. It's not, you know, crashing large buildings filled with people in the middle of cities. It is obviously something that organizations are going to need to deal with. And to some extent, United States security forces are going to need to be aware of. The FBI is, you know, these are crimes and the FBI needs to pay attention to them. But I think this is a lot of what Catherine just said, which is the FBI views this as a growing problem, as a big threat, and wants to get attention for that. And so is going to say, hey, it's another 9/11. It's not another 9/11. It's a different new thing that is... that we need to pay attention to and we need to be concerned about. Ransomware attacks are bad. That's my considered nuanced opinion. They're bad.
Smoking hot take.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh, that's
Catherine, isn't this
sit on an ice block after that hot take?
Some of our favorite slash least favorite neoliberal, just common sense writers out there were like, you know, Bitcoin just seems like a thing that allows for people to, you know, steal stuff on the dark web.
Do so the maybe, illegals.
Yeah. Maybe we should make it illegal, colon or something. However, that Bitcoin is the coin of the realm for people doing ransomwares. Totally. Right. Like it's end to end. Crypto blockchain. Am I out of my depth?
Wow, shush! Just you're embarrassing yourself.
It's
my man.
Cyber war.
It now has more Rexin in it as well, Matt. So yeah. It protects against bad breath.
Extra vitamin D.
So is this in fact the future libertarians created, Catherine, by enabling bot farms in Moldova to hold our precious infrastructure hostage,
Moldova,
so that they can Bitcoin the Numa Numa song. What say you?
I can't, like, the amount of insanity that just came out of your face in the last minute. I really am struggling, but I'm going to try and take that question on what I understand to be its own terms.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that technology enables, you know, lawbreaking or antisocial behavior is not a new one. It's like, oh, well, we wouldn't have had all those hijackings if we didn't have the airplanes. Like, yeah. I mean, I don't know what to say at some
Wright
point.
Brothers. The Wright brothers
are not responsible for, you know, terrorist hijackers any more than Satoshi Nakamoto is responsible for ransomware. There are always going to be...
You mean Neil Stephenson?
Yeah, I do. That is, as we've discussed on this podcast and in Reason Magazine, the conspiracy theory that I think... Peter has said it's the conspiracy theory he thinks is most likely to be true. I think he might have also invented it, that Satoshi Nakamoto is in whole or in part novelist Neil Stephenson. And I think that's right. But it's not Neil Stephenson's fault that there is ransomware. People who want to extract money from corporations or governments or individuals without having that money be traceable have always had ways to do it. Bitcoin might make that thing, or other crypto might make that thing slightly more efficient. But you know what? It also makes lots and lots of other things more efficient. And that's a trade we can make.
That's, I like that answer. Nick, did ransomware come up as far as you could tell? I know you're interviewing everybody, so you didn't see every presentation. But was that like a...
That's all people were talking about, Matt.
Is that true?
9/11 and ransomware? Yeah. No, of course not.
But like the dark side of security, I guess probably the focus would be more on just, you know, people who can't find their wallet or whatever. To what extent was the dark side discussed at the conference?
It comes up a bit, but, you know, one of the things that has happened, and again, this is a sign that Bitcoin is here to stay, is that the press and politicians, you know, kind of establishment, legacy, gatekeeper type people are amping up on the idea that the only reason for Bitcoin is ransomware, or, you know, the only reason for Bitcoin and or cash is criminal behavior. I literally read a tweet thread recently by some idiot in Britain who was like, the only use case for Bitcoin is criminal activity. That's it. You know, so it's like, and this kind of attack, as well as the one that Bitcoin uses too much energy. And people are like, there was a story recently in the New York Times, which was like, do you know that Bitcoin mining, which will phase out over time as more of the coins, the finite amount of coins get put into circulation. But Bitcoin mining consumes the same amount of electricity as like Sweden or the Netherlands or Argentina. And that's just a crime, right? Except that it actually has like a higher GDP. So like Bitcoin is a more productive use of electricity than all of Sweden. You know, and it's like we've gotten everything we want out of Sweden.
And this
they don't live there anymore so much.
Exactly.
But these attacks are coming faster and more furious, which is, and I think more people were talking about the idea that, Bitcoin is only there for criminal use, for ransomware, et cetera, that's people were chuckling at that because it's a sign that Bitcoin has delivered. And these are the weak last gasp attempts to delegitimize something that is not
cash.
And yet at the same time, I mean, the fact that Russ Ulbricht was speaking at this conference is obviously highly relevant, right?
Absolutely.
This is someone who is serving just an insanely
multiple life sentences
in prison because of that presumption, right? Like, essentially, the reason he is in prison is because of the underlying presumption that if he participated in any way in enabling people to use cryptocurrency online in order to come together in a voluntary way
to sell lots of stuff, including illegal drugs.
The whole point of the enterprise was to allow law breaking. And you know, he has said many times that that's not true. There are many, many reasons to think that's not true. And yet, you know, there's been, unfortunately, really no progress.
And it is not a small thing to, you know, kind of acknowledge that Silk Road, in many ways, if Bitcoin is the kind of demonstration project of blockchain technology, Silk Road was the demonstration project of Bitcoin as a market. Yeah. That worked. And this also goes back to that question, though, Matt. You know, Bitcoin is pseudonymous. It's not anonymous. This is something that became clear when Ross Ulbricht got caught. And there was a way of, you know, you can track Bitcoin transactions and to a fairly good degree of accuracy, you know, figure out who bought what and who didn't, because there's a ledger there that covers everything.
That's the whole idea,
yeah,
in fact.
So, you know, there's a lot of confusion about this kind of stuff, but it is, you know, that idea that Bitcoin equals criminality is we're going to hear that more and more until we don't hear it.
So when the FBI complains about Bitcoin and calls it about ransomware and calls it the new 9/11, that is in part driven by a kind of bureaucrat's fear of a new technology that is extra governmental and that does not play by the sort of normal rules of currency, right? And so the FBI and other security agencies just are used to dealing with banks and can get in and get bank records and know how to do that. And they feel like those bank records are in some sense owned by the bureaucracy, right? And there is a perception that Bitcoin is outside of their control and outside of their purview, and therefore it is extra worrying. And so some of that fear that you hear and that attempt to raise alarms amongst the press and the public about ransomware is just driven by the fact that the FBI always looks at stuff that is outside of its control, yeah, right?
And
says,
and again,
look, that must be scary, because if we can't monitor it, if we can't see every little thing on our own and sort of be involved with the centralized institution that is tracking this stuff, right? If there is no Visa, if there is no bank in between you and the person who you are doing with, then the FBI gets scared, because that makes their job harder, and they don't like not having that intermediary, which makes it possible for them to surveil people's private lives and transactions.
You know, again, just this is a media question as well. Like, suddenly Chris Wray, who, you know, a year ago was an idiot, right? And he was Trump's guy, all of this kind of stuff. Suddenly we all are paying attention to the FBI director in the 21st century. I mean, the FBI is one of the worst organizations that has ever been created in the history of America. And read Tim Weiner's fantastic book, Enemies, which, you know, goes through the Louis Free era, where each FBI director is worse than the next. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover is not even the worst, but they're either incompetent or awful or some combination of both. But again, you know, why is the media simply giving a megaphone over to, you know, somebody like Christopher Wray?
If you get an interview with the FBI director, you interview the FBI director, Nick.
But then ask. Now, I'm not saying you don't talk to the person, but like, did anybody push back? Did anybody ask about what's going on, you know, with other types of crime? You know, it's like, oh, you know, Chris Wray is like, it's a new 9/11. Did the FBI do a good job on the first 9/11? Why would we expect the FBI to know anything about anything other than how to infiltrate anti-war movements and try and screw them up?
Let's go to our email listener email of the week. Reminder, send them all by email to roundtable@reason.com. Please do try to be briefer than this week's contestant, the marvelously named Nicholas Fink from the equally marvelous town, city-state of Long Beach, California. Nicholas Fink writes, how does a good libertarian, he capitalized G and L, by the way, deal with the homeless issue? Does a person have the right to set up camp wherever they like, even in the middle of a downtown sidewalk with a tree well for a toilet? If so, maybe we're done already. If not, does the government have a responsibility to help people whose degree of mental illness makes it impossible to care for themselves? What about to help people who are addicted to drugs? What about to help people who were contributing members of society and could be again, but have experienced financial strains and are just dead broke? What about the people who are choosing to live life on the street to avoid getting a job and other responsibilities and et cetera? What say you, Catherine?
So this actually is a question I've been thinking about, in part because for a little while we had a couple of guys in tents outside of the Reason DC office, just around the corner. They were there. It was a small tent. They were seemed tidy enough. And I would say, even though I already had a pretty strong never call the cops attitude, this last year has really reinforced that view. And so never call the cops. That's a place to start, which means that the what was previously the default solution of like, hey, you can't camp on the sidewalk, so call the cops and the cops clear the people away, is now not available to a capital G, capital L good libertarian, in my view, or at least not in most cases.
Didn't Washington, D.C. also change their enforcement policy?
So there
for,
may. Yeah. Over
for
the pandemic
camps, at least in some locations.
Yeah, over the pandemic, especially when shelters closed, they did relax enforcement. And so it's not even clear that calling the cops would result in the cops moving these people away from the front of the Reason office. So
was it a new 9/11?
It was a new 9/11, Nick. And no, but I mean, the super simplistic answer is this is why you shouldn't have public property, which doesn't help anyone really right now. But it is genuinely that it's a lack of clear property rights and clear responsibilities that results in this problem. It's not, mental illness and financial hardship and all these other things are contributing factors. But the reason that there are people using tree boxes as toilets is because the property rights in those tree boxes are insufficiently clearly defined and don't have the right incentives aligned around them. So my answer is literally like privatize the roads. But my short term answer is, yeah, bro, it's really hard. And I don't exactly know what to say. And I will let Nick do the, hey, if the government didn't do a bunch of dumb bullshit, maybe they could use a little bit of money to help people who really need help.
Because maybe I think if the that's IRS part of the answer was too. A little better at collecting revenue, we'd have money left over.
But Thank I you. Think this is a really difficult and acute question right now in a lot of cities, especially. And I have like, on my walk to work most mornings, briefly struggle with this question and don't have a good answer.
If I may, first I want to ask a question of the assembled throng. Who among us hasn't used a tree box as a public toilet?
Like,
come on, I don't see any hands being raised.
Me.
Yeah. Well, maybe Catherine, but
I'm a
Peter
sophisticated
and,
lady. You know?
Yeah. I will say I do think this is a good question to ask of libertarians, especially libertarians as opposed to anarchists, right, or anarcho-capitalists. I think in Los Angeles, and I actually had a conversation with Dr. Drew Pinsky, who was briefly named to LA's homeless council, to try and deal with an out-of-control homeless problem in LA. And it's partly because LA, before the pandemic, had given up on, they just let tent cities proliferate all over the place. And they told the police not to move people, not to enforce them. And it pisses a lot of people off, especially if you are a property owner. It's bad as a renter. And I experienced that in Venice. But I can only imagine how annoyed you would be that you are paying for an immense amount of infrastructure and people are camping out and shitting, literally shitting on your front yard or on your sidewalk or whatever, and there's nothing you can do about it. I think that there's a soft answer to this, you start in stages, and one of the things to recognize is that a lot of the people who are on the street are drug addicts and mentally ill. And if they're not that way when they start out, they get there pretty quickly. And I think spending more money on social services that would reach out to people in a voluntary way to actually go out and try and get people to come in for various types of treatment or to be removed to a different type of situation where there's more surveillance for their sake as well as medical attention and whatnot is really helpful. There's a subsidiary issue here of if you are an addict, however we want to define this, and I think this would be a great long conversation for a future podcast. If you are an addict, are you capable of being an autonomous individual? And at what point, if any, do we say as a society, you know, in the form of governmental agents saying you are no longer able of taking care of yourself. We're going to remediate you at least for a short period of time. I think a good libertarian answer to this is to actually beef up the social services that would directly allow homeless people to get shelter and to get the kind of treatment that might allow them to stop being homeless. That doesn't get to the not insubstantial portion of people who just don't want to live inside or in normal society. But I think the vast majority of the problem and the sense of chaos would be greatly diminished if we actually spent a lot of tax dollars helping people.
So Los Angeles is spending about $2,600 per person per month to set up a tent, basically a tent city in a parking lot. And that seems to me like the wrong way to spend taxpayer money on these problems.
I agree.
The things that I would add to what has already been said are that we should, Nick brought up the drug addiction issue. I would just say that drug legalization should be part of the homelessness discussion, because when drugs are legalized, and when we are not just sort of arresting people, and when it's not stigmatized, that is going to make treating those people and caring for them a lot easier. But the other thing is, we're talking about homelessness here in the way that it's really sort of seen and felt on the streets, and that's obviously a big issue right now in cities. But if you look at official counts of homelessness, what they actually do is they also count a lot of people who sleep in many cases with roofs over their heads. But they don't have a place of their own. Now, sometimes that means they're also sleeping in their cars for nights at a time. I'm not saying this that these people have easy lives, but they're not the people who are just living on the streets every single day. They're in a sort of intermediate, other difficult place. And in many cases, that's about them not having the resources to be able to get an affordable place in often in a city. And the best way that we can address that is to end restrictions on building housing, because that is what is driving up the cost of housing in major urban areas.
Let's go to our end of show. What you have been consuming culturally,
Matt? Do you not
Nick,
care about?
You
the
can
homeless?
Host your own. You can host your own podcast and mind your own clock.
He does ours, on Wednesdays.
Ours is at the 60-minute mark, and so we're going to the end of our podcast. If someone wants to sleep in a tent on the sidewalk
bastard.
In front of my house, I don't want that to be. I don't want that to be legal. I will say that, and I agree with Peter that homelessness is the flower. The fruit of really bad housing policy that doesn't allow for the building of new houses and for the median price to be $1 million and God knows how many places, and where places where housing is cheap, you're not going to see a lot of homeless people. I think we treat the problem at the end stupidly, and then that's mixed with a bunch of other weird mixed up, shook up policies that create just absolutely disgusting urban environments, like in places like San Francisco. So that's the answer to your question. So Nick, what have you been consuming?
I had read this before, but I consumed the Bullish Case for Bitcoin, the book length version of Vijay Boyapati's article from originally 2017. It's a Kickstarter book that is already out. You can still go to Kickstarter and buy the book. It's got a few days left to open. But The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Boyapati, who is an immigrant from Australia to the Pacific Northwest. It's a wonderful, optimistic, easy to understand, conceptually great case for Bitcoin.
With the a only terrible
thing,
cover.
Yeah, the only thing that really, and this might be a deal killer for not just for this book, but for cryptocurrency in general and blockchain technology, is the cover is a Bitcoin Minotaur. Because he's bullish, and I guess the Minotaur is a bullhead holding a sledgehammer that has 21 million out of that's
like,
the number of Bitcoin.
It feels like that metaphor is doing more work than it meant to.
Yeah, it's
like the
it's,
Minotaur
the
is
cover,
not,
the
he's
cover
trapped,
is,
y'all.
I don't, yeah, that's true. The Minotaur really isn't the hero of that story,
no,
right?
But, not so as you
but
notice.
The Minotaur does, I don't, yeah, he doesn't really win in the end either, right?
No.
Yeah, no. Yeah, there's a lot, well, in any case.
It's a bull. He's just a bull.
The
it's
bullish
a cool
case
bull.
For Bitcoin. By Vijay Boyapati. I recommend people, if you are into this space, it's a great book, but especially if you are, you know, trying to pick it up on the fly, it's very good.
Speaking of Minotaurs, Peter, what have you been
consuming? I watched The Mayor of Easttown on HBO. Mm-hmm. It is a 7-episode limited series mystery starring Kate Winslet as a smallish town detective in Pennsylvania, in sort of ruralish Pennsylvania. It's so good, guys. It's just so good. It's exactly what you want from like a 2-month long HBO hour long, like prestige mystery. It's got Guy Pearce as like a maybe creepy, but maybe not kind of like middle-aged old man literary professor. It's just like a really great cast. It's got Jean Smart, who's just wonderful in everything, playing Kate Winslet's mom. But what it really has is a deep sense of place. And a deep sense of people, right? And like how people are intimately connected to a place, and also how that place connects people to each other. And so ultimately, it becomes a story about how families are hard, and they require people to make difficult decisions, and sacrifices, and you sort of can't predict them what those will be in advance, but they're going to hit you at some point, and you never know exactly what they will be or what they will require of you. It's a great, great, just like peak TV era, you know, sophisticated adult drama that works pretty much every scene for 7 episodes, which a lot of these shows just kind of peter out. They just don't work at some point. Their endings aren't satisfying. This one has a perfectly plausible, perfectly satisfying ending. It's the show ended a week from it's been out, it's been done for about a week now, but if you have HBO Now or whatever service like that, you will be able to get it. It is highly worth the time investment.
I agree with you, Peter, and you know, both Kate Winslet and Jean Smart even more so are having like fabulous late and, you know, end of careers. But I also, anybody who's out there who has seen ads for this show, do not be put off by all of the NPR and New York Times commentary about how great the accents are. Because there was
That's mostly what I've consumed about this show.
Like, oh, you know, that's a tough accent.
But Kate Winslet did this hard accent.
Yeah, for like a 3-block area in like, you know, deindustrialized eastern Pennsylvania. And it like made me not want to watch the show, because it's like if they're talking about the accents, it really's got to suck. But I agree with you, Peter. It's a
Kate
very,
Winslet
very
has
good
a, is British and Guy Pearce is Australian. And when you hear them speak in their normal like British and Australian accents and then hear them speak in very colloquial Pennsylvania English, it is pretty impressive. But what's impressive about it is that unless somebody's saying, hey, these accents are incredible, if you're just watching the show, you don't notice. It doesn't feel like someone is doing
here
it
in the
yes,
US.
Right? And yeah. I don't think the accents needed as much attention as they got. Yeah. However, they are impressively sub rosa
rendered.
Catherine, yes. What have you been consuming?
I caved to peer pressure and watched the Bo Burnham Netflix special Inside, which I regret a little. I like the TikToks, as y'all know, and there's a lot of Bo Burnham on TikTok, or at least on my TikTok, which of course is different than everyone else's TikTok. Thank you, robots. And
thank you,
can you give
Chinese
me like
Communist
a, can you
Party.
Give me like a 10-second robots. Brief ID on who Bo Burnham is, because I've only heard
I would
Bo
love
Burnham.
To.
Is he the yes. one who deserted in Afghanistan?
Yeah. That was a different Bo. There's a bunch of Bos, yeah. not
or
this
one. Or is he the no-hit pitcher in the early years of the California Angels?
Yeah. He's a different Bo.
That's the Los Angeles Angels, Nick. Correct yourself. Go, Catherine, please.
He's a content creator, a comedian, just some dude. And he was like, hey, I'm going to spend the whole year inside this room, so I'm going to do a one-man special. And it's going to be like a Netflix, you know, prestige comedy special, except for I'm just going to make it in this room by myself. And his deal is that he has like a synth and he does these like very catchy, earwormy songs about the absolute darkness inside both his own heart and our society. So I struggled a little bit with the fact that in the end, his sort of lazy diagnosis is like, capitalism is probably bad. And like at one point, a literal sock puppet, like he has a literal sock on his hand and the sock is doing like, you know, Marxian class analysis for a minute in song, which like, you know, when a sock is saying the word neoliberal fascist to you, it's like that shouldn't that shouldn't work. It does work. It's pretty funny.
I dispute.
There's a bunch of extremely, extremely catchy songs which have been pulled out and used as sounds, as audio on TikTok. And so then it creates this kind of weird memes of songs about how memes are poisoning your brain because capitalism is bad. And also the whole thing is like really excruciatingly self-conscious about the fact that like he's a white dude doing a whole bit about how like the capitalism that white dudes built is ruining everything. Excruciatingly self-conscious, but it's all with perky electronic music, and it's super, super compelling. I watched the whole thing very quickly and easily, and I didn't cringe, which normally I struggle with comedy. I cannot go to improv. Sorry, Andrew Heaton. Cannot, will not. Sorry, Kat Timpf. Like, stand-up is hard for me because I have a really low sympathetic embarrassment threshold. Like, someone embarrassing themselves on stage makes me suffer.
Yes, and you also never.
And so I can't do that. This did not elicit that response in me. It like is very smooth and
but you
flows.
Didn't like it, or are you recommending it?
I am recommending
yeah,
it,
I can't
and
tell if
I didn't
a recommendation.
Like it. I found it to be a very, very, very interesting thing that yeah. was it went down smooth, but made me feel bad after.
I want Matt Welch's review, since he's the guy who keeps the synthesizer next to his microphone for podcasting.
Matt Welch's review.
This dude
of
is
this
definitely Gen Z Matt Welch.
People are talking a lot. Speaking of one-man shows,
yeah, that
late
happens on a podcast.
Shut it. Speaking of one-man shows and late capitalism, I vociferously recommend, in a non-ironic sense, the Bay of Pigs Museum in Miami, Cuba, near Calle Ocho. It is basically a two-room house museum staffed by a guy named Eduardo Zayas Bazan, who was a frog man in the Bay of Pigs. Wow. Got his leg shot, and he sits in a big room around a table and tells you his life story, or just the Bay of Pigs part of it, for 40 minutes, takes questions, at least he did in our case, and it has little artifacts. The big thing is they basically have pictures in the next room of everybody who took part. There's like 1,200 Cuban exiles who took part in the Bay of Pigs
Patriots invasion.
And I was really actually surprised. He's an 85-year-old dude. Like Cubans, they live forever. Sharp as a tack, a lot sharper than our current and former president. Just sort of spinning it out. But he was actually very kind of he was giving a background contemporary or, you know, mid 20th century Cuban politics. Was pretty fair about like Castro at first, that he was popular and why he was popular, and how Batista started out good, then turned bad. And he kind of gets into the history of elections. And he's pretty balanced about the whole thing, given the fact that he got shot during the Pigs invasion. It's just great. There's stuff there for definitely for anti-interventionists, for pro-interventionists, or for people who just like to hear old, very smart Cuban guys. He ended up being a professor at like East Tennessee State, I think, and has a book out this year called My Life, because that hadn't been tried before. It was really a grand time. Can't recommend it enough. And that's all the recommendations we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Listen to all of our stuff at reason.com/podcasts, I think. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.